Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So we'll begin reading this week's Triangle Business Journal at our usual spot, that is the Biz page, which has a number of short articles on Triangle happenings. Under the heading of Great Idea comes the article, Making Christmas Classic Appealing to Those with Autism. An autism-friendly performance of Elf the Musical at the Durham Performing Arts Center is getting a boost from UNC Healthcare. The system has donated more than 2,000 sensory-friendly kits for those who attend, and volunteers from the UNC Autism Research Center in Chapel Hill will be at the December the 8th performance to assist as well. The kits include a stress ball, a fidget spinner, and a bendy stick. We recognize that events with loud noises, bright lights, and unfamiliar surroundings can make it difficult for some individuals to enjoy their theater experience, said Allison Zoller, program manager of the UNC Autism Research Center. We want to offer some respite for those people, their family members, and caregivers. The performance is designed for those on the autism spectrum and anyone who might prefer a more relaxed environment. Autism refers to a broad range of issues that impact a person's ability to interact with others. And under the heading of Huge Home comes the article, NC Mansion Featured in Movie Sold and Could Be Demolished. A massive Greensboro mansion featured in a film with British actress Kate Beckinsale has been sold, and its future is uncertain. Jason Harris, co-owner of Furnitureland South, paid $2.4 million for the 10-bedroom Adams Leigh Mansion at Sedgefield Country Club. The home was built in 1930 by textile magnate J.H. Hamp Adams, but Harris told Triad Business Journal, "We don't have an affinity for the home. It's not part of our legacy or history or family. The house is not in a livable condition." Asked if it could be demolished, he said, "It's very possible." In the 2014 film The Disappointments Room, Beckinsale's character and her son are terrified at an old and haunted house. And under the heading of War Years comes the article, Time in Chapel Hill Helped Mold a Young George Bush. In 1942, future President George H.W. Bush enlisted in the Navy with dreams of becoming a pilot. He was selected for the rigorous U.S. Navy pre-flight program, which led him to the Triangle. Bush took a train from New York's Penn Station and arrived in Chapel Hill, where he lived in room 317 at Lewis Residence Hall on the UNC campus. The grueling training included competitive sports designed to toughen recruits, and the military wanted the best coaches it could find, including Bear Bryant. Bush would later recall digging ditches and the thrill of a Coke and relief from the southern heat. And as John Meacham wrote in Destiny and Power, Bush also appreciated a visit from Barbara Pierce, where they walked the campus, had a sandwich, and ducked into the press box at Keenan Stadium when a storm blew over. And under the heading of Accolade, next time be sure to stop at this mountain town. Here in the Triangle, it's easy to think of Marion as a place to stop for a break en route to the heart of the North Carolina mountains. But the small town just off I-40 recently got a major honor when the North Carolina Rural Center honored it as a 2018 Small Town of the Year. The Rural Center, says Marion, has transformed its downtown into a gathering place, thanks to collaboration between businesses and the government. The award acknowledges how a combination of efforts, including a new emphasis on growing entrepreneurs, as well as a major streetscape program, have transformed the city. The efforts have led to 34 full-time jobs and 12 part-time jobs, small numbers for a place such as the Triangle, but big news in the state's small towns. Congrats! And the next time Biz heads west, we're stopping by. And under the heading of Ride Along comes the article, Now Law School Students Can Ride a Bike and Talk Torts, Too. In the corporate world, there are plenty of ideas for how to get routine conference meetings moving, but no one has the perfect solution. Campbell Law School, in the spirit of ingenuity, is taking that challenge literally and further than most. Downtown Raleigh visitors may soon see seven future lawyers on a bright orange bicycle hashing out their latest problem. That's because Campbell Law School Dean Rich Leonard purchased a conference bicycle he spotted on a trip to Vienna last year, believing it could enhance both the collaboration and fitness efforts of the school. And he noted that generous donors have provided discretionary funds for the sole purpose of doing unique and creative things. The bike, known as a Kobi, was built in Holland and painted Campbell orange. The bike is the same used by Google, Cirque du Soleil, the Helen Keller National Center, and the Earth Center in York, England. It's available for faculty, staff, and student meetings. The recent addition of bike lanes downtown has made its application even more practical, Leonard says. And finally, from the biz page under the heading Big Gift comes the article, Raleigh Gets Another Chance to Highlight Public Art. Raleigh isn't just known as a haven for public art. Just ask Spanish artist Jaime Plensa. So it was with a note of enthusiasm that the Raleigh City Council accepted a gift of an estimated $550,000 for a public work at its regular session on December 4th. The money comes from the estate of the late Victor and Carolyn Kavarock. Victor Kavarock, a former NC State University professor of geology, died in 2017. And Carolyn Kavarock, a concert violinist, passed away in January. The gift will help fund the Canopy Public Art Project at the new Union Station. Sarah Powers of the city staff said the work will be done by local artist Thomas Sayre. According to the city, Sayre's design will create an integrated structural skin to provide filtered shade on Union Station's plaza. He is, like all of us, ready to get started, Powers told the council. The work on the east end of Union Station will provide filtered shade and have a theme that dates back to maps of the world from the 17th century. The work, currently titled Breath of Gods, will have images depicting the gods of the universe blowing breath into the ocean to propel sailboats on their journeys. Sayre created the prominent circular sculptures at the NC Museum of Art, the shimmer wall of the Raleigh Convention Center, and the recent Oberlin Rising sculpture on Oberlin Road. Now we turn to the banking and startups page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Beyond the Deal comes the article Public Records Outline Argument for NC Incentives. The 800-job Triangle Tire announcement, and this tire is spelled T-Y-R-E. The Triangle Tire announcement last year had Japanese tire maker Bridgestone afraid the new competition would create a drain on skilled workforce availability, records show. In December 2017, Chinese tire manufacturer Triangle Tire said it would bring its first U.S. manufacturing plant to Edgecombe County. But NC Department of Commerce documents show officials at Bridgestone's Wilson County facility were so worried about talent retention, they asked the state for incentives worth up to $3 million annually. The business climate has shifted significantly with Triangle Tire, Bridgestone told the state in an incentives application signed by Mitch Burke, Wilson plant manager, on August 22nd. Without funds to assist with the plant's training costs, the resulting upward cost pressures in Wilson could mean less investments and less production. The firm estimated the market value of its Wilson operation to be $871.2 million at the end of 2018 and just $663.2 million in 2023 without the capital infusion the grant would facilitate. The state's Economic Investments Committee approved Bridgestone's incentives request in October, provided Bridgestone makes at least $150 million in improvements over a six-year period. And under the heading of New Path comes the article, Proposed Raleigh Bank Changes Its Plan. A group of investors trying to create the first Raleigh Bank startup since 2006 is changing its plans. Separate representatives of the NC Office of the Commissioner of Banks and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation both confirmed that Raleigh's Dogwood State Bank has voluntarily withdrawn its applications for their respective organizations. The bank's founding CEO, Steve Jones, was quick to say the bank is still moving forward, just via a different pathway. He declined to offer details, but said Dogwood State Bank continues to see success in its fundraising efforts. Likewise, the bank's proposed chairman, former Yadkin CEO Scott Custer, shared his optimism, but was short on specifics. "I think it's all very encouraging," he says. "We have what I believe is a new and slightly different path to follow, and really can't say much about it today. One option could be bypassing the state for a national charter with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which would still require FDIC insurance, meaning Dogwood State Bank would have to resubmit its application. The bank could also elect to buy a charter instead of applying for one. A small North Carolina-domiciled bank could find the benefit of having a lot of capital behind it with some well-pedigreed bankers," notes Lee Burrows, CEO of Bank Street Partners. Custer, who recently left his position at Wilmington's Live Oak Bank, has done it previously, making a string of acquisitions that resulted in Yadkin Financial, which, prior to its acquisition by FNB Corporation, was the largest community bank in North Carolina. And along with this article, there's a small graphic here on the new banks that are emerging. And the article graphic reads, "De novo activity is picking up across the country, as the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has approved more banks in 2018 than in 2017 and 2016 combined. So in 2016, there were two, in 2017, there were eight, and in 2018, there were 11. And under the heading of M&A, the article is Feel Goods Makes a Buy. Raleigh-based footwear brand Feel Goods has made its first acquisition of eco-accessories brand Rising Tide. Financial details were not disclosed. Feel Goods co-founder Mark Saad says the combined firm plans to leverage both brands' existing relationships with Whole Foods to expand within the Amazon-owned grocery store's ecosystem. "We're really excited about what it means for profitability and growth for us," he said. "With Whole Foods, we've got great relationships with all the buyers. We just need to keep riding the Whole Foods wave." Right now, both brands are in the same section at Whole Foods, though they sell on the opposite season we do. The flip-flops Feel Good sells do best in the summer months, while the hats, scarves, and gloves that Massachusetts-based Rising Tide produces attract more customers in the fall and winter months. As of January, both brands will be using Feel Good's new 20,000-square-foot warehouse and distribution facility. Feel Goods, led by CEO Max Sullivan, has about 15 employees, with Rising Tide adding another 8. And under the heading of lawsuit comes the article, Chef Accused of Stealing Only Copy of Restaurant Chain's Master Recipe Book. 7 years after flying him in from Venezuela, the two Raleigh-based companies behind restaurant brand Guasaca are suing their former head chef, charging that he stole the only copy of the recipe book, costing them customers and proprietary arepas. That chef, Jose Alvarez Coroba, declined to comment through his attorney. Real Food Central and HJO Concept referred to as Guasaca in the lawsuit, have filed a 23-page lawsuit against the chef and stakeholder, who, after three all-expense-paid trips to the U.S., was offered a job with the brand in 2011. They claim they hired an immigration lawyer, paying the legal expenses so that Coroba could get a work visa. And when the first Guasaca restaurant opened in 2012, they insist they continued to collaborate, guiding Coroba on flavors needed for Guasaca food items to be successful in the American consumer market. Guasaca has three locations in Raleigh, Durham, and Morrisville. For security purposes, Guasaca states in the lawsuit that there is just one single hard copy of the recipes it claims it helped Coroba create. The master recipe book, with 40 pages of secret ingredients, quantities, ingredient combinations, and notations, was in Coroba's possession, the lawsuit states, but Guasaca claims it was still proprietary information and the property of the brand, not the chef. On November 16th, Coroba resigned, absconding with the Guasaca recipe book and refusing to return the original copy in his possession, the lawsuit claims. Coroba, through his attorney, provided an electronic copy of what he claims is a complete recipe book, but according to Guasaca, it is incomplete, inaccurate, not current, and lacked key recipes essential to the Guasaca menu. Despite repeated demands, Kuroba has not returned the book, Wasaka claims. Now we turn to the real estate page, this week's Triangle Journal, and under the heading of Going Vertical comes the article, Highwoods Plots 20-Story Building Near Moore Square. Highwoods Properties is reviving plans to build a 20-story mixed-use office tower on a downtown parcel that the publicly traded real estate company acquired 2 years ago. Senior Highwoods officials say final development plans are in the hands of Rule, Joy, Trammell, and Rubio. The Atlanta-based architectural firm is modifying the plans originally submitted by the previous owner of the 0.7-acre site, Edison Land LLC, an affiliate of Beacon Partners. Those plans have already been approved by the city and call for a 20-story tower totaling about 300,000 square feet, according to documents filed with the city. The property, currently a parking lot, is at the corner of Wilmington and Martin Streets, next to Sky House Raleigh high-rise apartment building, and across the street from the 33-story PNC Tower, the city's tallest building. Highwoods bought the property in two separate transactions totaling more than $7.5 million. The new building proposal adds to the growing list of prominent towers in the works for downtown Raleigh and comes at a time that at least two companies have revealed plans for new headquarters facilities in the city. The state recently announced multi-million-dollar incentives packages for Advance Auto Parts and tech company Pendo to bring hundreds of jobs and new headquarters to Raleigh. Highwood's latest project includes office and retail space, as well as six stories dedicated to parking, providing 330 spaces accessed through the fourth floor of the neighboring Blunt Street parking deck. And as mentioned in the Highwood's article, under the heading of Staffing Up comes the article Pendo Seeking New Space in Downtown Raleigh. A fast-growing Raleigh startup is looking to make its mark with a new headquarters building and 590 new jobs. Pendo plans to add the new employees over the next 5 years as part of a state incentive package awarded on December the 3rd that totals nearly $11 million. Pendo is now focused on buying land and building new office space for the company's primary engineering hub. It will be in downtown Raleigh, Pendo CEO Todd Olson says. We're talking with a number of developers now. The average wages of the added jobs will be $86,824, well above the average Wake County wage of $56,245. The firm specializes in using cloud technology and analytics to help companies better understand their customers. Pendo currently operates out of space at the Wells Fargo Capital Center on Fayetteville Street, where it signed a new lease earlier this year. But those offices can only accommodate 400 total employees. Pendo currently employs 238 people, including 171 in Raleigh, where it plans to add 590 more. Olson says the company is running out of desks. We just can't fit, he says. The company plans to make a final decision on the location and developer of the new headquarters early next year. The state incentive package comes with the stipulation that Pendo make a capital investment of $34.56 million by the end of 2021. Of that amount, $12 million will likely go toward property acquisition, while another $21 million would be put toward construction. The incentive package includes $8.79 million through the state's Job Development Investment Grant Program, $986,000 from Wake County and the City of Raleigh, and $885,000 from the North Carolina Community College System. And finally, under the real estate page comes a short article under the heading of Thwarted. Sale of prime condos next to Cameron Village collapses after owner holds out. The sale of an aging condo complex next to Cameron Village has fallen through. The Worthing Companies, an apartment developer, had been trying to buy the 4.9-acre site of the Bellwood condominiums, but the deal could only be finalized if all 51 owners of the property agreed to sell. One of the owners didn't agree, Worthing and the Homeowners Association said, and now the future of a prime redevelopment site is once again up in the air. The Homeowners Association board sent an email to owners November 26 saying, "It is with a heavy heart that we share the news that we did not receive 100% sales ratification." Homeowners at the property had been trying to sell because of the mounting maintenance costs required for the upkeep of the aging community originally built in the 1940s. Now, the life sciences contribution this week is sort of small. It's one article, and it's entitled Expansion, Novo Nordisk Ramping Up in Clayton. As pharmaceutical production continues to expand in counties east of the Triangle, Novo Nordisk has announced another $22 million expansion of its Clayton facility, including 22 more jobs. The announcement comes less than a year since the Danish company announced a $65 million expansion. On December the 3rd, the Johnson County Board of Commissioners approved a 7-year package of financial incentives, the company's fourth since 2010. The incentive package, contingent on the company's completion of the project and hiring 22 new employees, will provide a 7-year incentive grant. The grant's estimated at $85,800 annually, about $600,000 over the whole period. County officials say that number could vary with the actual taxes the company pays. We greatly appreciate the support of the Johnston County Board of Commissioners and the community at large for the quarter century we've called Clayton home, said Chad Henry, Corporate Vice President and General Manager of Novo Nordisk in Clayton. Novo Nordisk has about 1,200 manufacturing employees in the county, with a $2 billion, 700 employee ongoing expansion that was announced in 2015. In February, the company also announced an additional $65 million, 18-job expansion project at its Clayton site. Both that and this newest development are expansions of the existing plant to increase manufacturing capacity by adding new production lines. According to company officials, the expansions will not necessarily expand the physical footprint of the facility. Both projects are expected to be complete by 2020. Hiring for the new production lines began earlier this year. Now, under the section of education comes the article Honored, Three Triangle Students Score Marshall Scholarships. Three students from Triangle Universities are among the 40 U.S. students to receive a 2019 Marshall Scholarship. The scholarship provides cost of living and tuition costs for students to study at any university in England. This year, two students from Duke University and one from UNC Chapel Hill were selected for the award. The announcement comes just weeks after three Duke students were named Rhodes Scholars. Julie Uchitel and Shomik Verma from Duke and Maggie Hildebrand from UNC were selected from more than 1,000 other applicants. Hildebrand, UNC's 18th Marshall Scholar, is from Asheville. She's scheduled to graduate with a double major in physics and religious studies, along with a minor in history. Professionally, she aspires to perform astrophysics research for NASA, where she has twice served as an intern. Uchitel, from Southampton, Pennsylvania, is scheduled to graduate with majors in neuroscience and French. Verma, from Houston, is majoring in mechanical engineering with minors in energy engineering and mathematics. And in other education news, under the heading of Promising, comes the article, NC State's 5G Technology Starting to Get Noticed. Though 5G systems remain a future technology, NC State University researchers are developing the technologies now. Next month, in the United Arab Emirates, NC State Assistant Professor Shi Jun Lin will present his research on technology that improves cellular communication nodes in 5G systems to partition bandwidth more efficiently, improving data transmission rates. He says in simulations, the approach makes possible the international goal of 10 gigabits per second. The technology is a framework that takes into account data transfer rates, wired and wireless bandwidth availability, and the power of base stations in a 5G network, Lin says. It then uses stochastic optimization modeling to determine the most efficient means of transferring and retrieving data, and it does this very quickly without using a lot of computing power. And finally, on the education heading, comes the article, International Students Still Coming Here. Though educators around the nation are concerned about the emerging trend of decreasing international students at their schools, the Triangle's major universities have not seen a drop in their foreign student enrollments. Recently, the Institute for International Education released its annual Open Doors report, showing a 6.6% drop in international students' enrollment in fall 2017. The drop follows a 3% drop in 2016. Year-to-year enrollment among international students has not dropped since 2003. In the triangle, though, the three major universities have hit all-time highs for their international students, reporting between 2 and 12% growth during the same period. And in the year-over-year change since, two universities have seen noteworthy growth, whereas one broke even. Historically, the most drastic growth for international students in the Triangle has been at NC State University, which reported 4,052 international students this year, an 82% growth compared to 10 years ago. In 2013, the university had 3,136 international students, marking a growth of 29% in the last 5 years. Between 2016 and 17, the same period that nationally saw the 6.6% drop, the university grew by 4%, from 3,893 to 4,052 students. But in the year since, the university has seen no growth, reporting 4,052 students for fall 2018 as well. Duke University enrollment has also exploded over the last 10 years. Also bucking the national trend, it grew its international student body by 12% between 2016 and 2017. This year, it reported 3,413 international students, a 5% increase over last year, and 20% growth since 2008. Its five-year growth rate increased 3%. While UNC Chapel Hill has considerably fewer international students than the other two universities, it has also seen substantial growth. This year, UNC reported 1,726 international students, a 31% increase from 2008. Since 2013, the university has grown the population by 9%. In the 2016-17 period, UNC reported 2% growth, followed by 6% this year. The Institute for International Education cited several factors for the national decrease of students, including rising tuition costs and increased competition from other countries. This week's cover story is entitled The Rise of Elder Orphans, or Who'll Leave a Light On? Wanda Terrell's life shifted in July. She and her husband John were married 46 years. They moved to a Raleigh apartment in 1972 and eventually bought a home close to North Hills. He rose through the ranks at IBM, and she loved life in the center of the city as Raleigh rose around them. He died on July 11th, and a stunned Wanda, who had no children, faced a world that's becoming remarkably common as America ages. She suddenly faced the complex world of health care and the other challenges for the older population, and she was on her own. "I didn't know what I was doing," Terrell says. "I was just bewildered, kind of lost." Her situation is far from unusual. One study found that more than one-fifth of Americans are at risk of being alone as they age. Add to that the decreasing number of caregivers, an expensive health care system, and a new crop of blue-collared swindlers and scammers, and elder orphans are facing an uphill battle as they get older. Raleigh attorney Bill Alexander is well aware of the trend. He was making a good living in the 1990s as an estate tax attorney when his father died, leaving Alexander as the primary caregiver for his brother, a former UNC Chapel Hill gymnast disabled by a traumatic brain injury. "My parents established a trust for my brother, and, of course, I was very interested in that," he says of the line of work. "So that pushed me towards special needs planning in a big way." A few years later, Alexander's mother began to face health issues, and he learned more about elder care as she moved to an assisted living facility and then a nursing home. "I ended up with some hands-on practical experience," he says. As a result, he pivoted his law practice to specializing in elder care and found plenty of people in need. Many aging Americans find themselves with no one available and slip into the category of elder orphans, a cohort that has frightening and costly consequences. They are the largest group that gets scammed for thousands of dollars. It's because scammers know how to play into those people, and they're good at it, Alexander says. And it's very hard for families when they don't have control of the checkbook to protect people. It's just another unfortunate situation. A friend of Terrell suggested she hire an attorney, and she turned to Alexander. She also has a case manager to help. Terrell recommends that as people age, they should make sure both partners have access to all financial accounts and that both are familiar with the nuances of taxes and other duties that are sometimes divided among spouses. It's a humbling experience to go through this, she says. You think you're smart and you don't know anything. Women find themselves particularly at risk of lacking support as they get older. American women live an average of 81 years, according to the National Center for Health Statistics, about 5 years longer than males. Nancy Ruffner, a health care advocate and president of Raleigh's Navigate NC, recently began providing specific services to that population from her company. We haven't made as much, so we don't have as much in our Social Security accounts, and we don't have as much as in our IRAs, she says of women in the workforce. We haven't been dealt a very fair deck. I feel the vulnerability, but also feel compelled to do something about it, Ruffner adds. I need to get out there and bang the drum. Some larger demographic trends are contributing to the rise of elder orphans, with the elderly population growing at a pace that's outstripping some younger generations as the baby boomers age. But that's not the only factor in the trend. The 2010 U.S. Census found that 19% of women from the age of 40 to 44 had no children. In a 2016 article published in Current Gerontology and Geriatrics Research, Dr. Maria Carney pointed to those numbers to explain there's a large segment of the American population that's at risk of becoming an elder orphan. She cited the Health and Retirement Study, that's HRS, conducted by the National Center of Aging to develop a number. This demographic, those aging alone with limited support, is expected to increase as the United States population continues to age, and people live in the community with more chronic illnesses, wrote Carney, who practices in New York. Based on data from the HRS, we estimate that the prevalence of being at high risk for elder orphan status is to be as high as 22.6%. The current local population of elder orphans is harder to define. A 2016 study by SeniorCare.com, an advocacy site designed to provide resources and assistance to elder orphans, found that there were 10,510 seniors living alone in Raleigh, 6,518 in Durham, and 1,588 in Chapel Hill. That doesn't necessarily mean they are elder orphans, as they may have family nearby that provides support. But the trend toward a lower number of caregivers is undeniable. A 2015 report by the AARP stated that the average number of potential family caregivers for every person 80 and older was 7.2 in 2010, but likely to fall to 4 in 2013 and 3, sorry, to fall to 4 in 2030 and 3 in 2050. The number of births in the United States and estimated births per woman have also dropped in recent years. In North Carolina, 15% of the population is 65 and older, while just 5.9% is 5 and under. Scams are just one of the challenges elder orphans can often face on their own. Alexander has a deep understanding on the levers of government as a former member of the North Carolina General Assembly and also a research assistant for the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, particularly on the Watergate scandal. He says the current health care system, especially Medicaid, Medicare, and Veterans Affairs benefits, is impossible for the average person to understand alone. For example, he says Medicaid only deals with nursing home care, while the state-level special assistance program helps low-income individuals with assisted living situations. Unfortunately, most professionals call both programs Medicaid, Alexander says. There's not a book that you can buy that tells anybody about North Carolina Medicaid. Even the caseworkers don't understand it. The only way you really understand it is to really know it, and that takes experience. Then there are benefits from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, such as the Improved Pension Program. The IPP can offer benefits for elderly veterans, but they must have served on active duty during a period of wartime. North Carolina, Alexander says, is a little better than some of its neighbors, he said, but it still ain't great. That's why people need help, he says. This problem is just going to get worse. North Carolina, a special assistance program in North Carolina, as bad as it is better than any of the states around us, which is a really sad thing for us to think about. I'm thankful for the fact that we have a program that helps some of our people, but I've seen so many folks that fall outside that safety net. So there's just that big hole in the safety net and the saddest situations. It's impossible to write a book that's understandable for the layman because every state has different rules. There are even three different Medicaid systems that are authorized by the feds among all the different states. Even though it's based on federal law, every state has different rules, and that obviously makes it more confusing as well. Various entities, from hospitals to nonprofits, are adjusting patterns of care and assistance to handle the growing number of elder orphans in North Carolina. Christina Hendricks, an associate professor at the Duke University School of Nursing, focuses on care for the elderly and says more than 40% of the patients at the three Duke hospitals, two in Durham and one in Raleigh, are people over the age of 65 at any given time. That number will only grow, as she says the percentage of the U.S. population over the age of 65 will hit 20% by the year 2030. And the impact of the current population having a small number of children will only increase as the years go by. And while she can't put an exact number on how many are elder orphans, she says, we're beginning to see an increase in the number of older adults getting discharged without any declared caregiver or they are living at home. That's of high concern to hospitals, who know that patients can face a critical period of recovery once they leave the hospital. When you discharge somebody from the hospital and you know there's nobody to be with this patient, you're concerned about the safety of the person, Hendricks says. How would you know if the person's recovering? How would you know if there are complications? She says as people age, they should consider getting advanced directives, develop buddy systems, and seek out services such as Meals on Wheels that help them live on their own. We are all interconnected, Hendricks says. When one is suffering, the other ones suffer. At UNC Rex Healthcare in Raleigh, the hospital doesn't have exact numbers on elder orphans that have sought services, but anecdotally, the number is on the rise. Social workers step in to provide assistance to all patients who are at the hospital for a day or more, looking at medical history and readmissions and performing an assessment. When there's no family member or guardian, those social workers help make decisions about discharge or admission to a rehab or nursing facility. Navigate NC's Ruffner started offering elder orphan services this year, citing the growing number of people over 65 in North Carolina. Her firm served as advocate for clients, with one page on the firm's website saying a client called a Navigate representative her professional relative. We're an objective third party to speak for folks who may not have a voice, she says. That's crucial, Ruffner says, in the difficulty of life without family or close friends. It's all about answering the question, how do we navigate the health care maze? But the issue is hardly limited to North Carolina or even the United States. Another group in North Carolina even goes beyond the boundaries of the state. In 2011, Mecklenburg County resident Kim Jackson started working with the nonprofit Remember the Children, an Illinois-based Christian organization that cares for orphans in Romania. She soon took over the part of the nonprofit that served at-risk elderly, calling it Elder Orphan Care. 5 years later, EOC became its own separate nonprofit, working in Romania, as well as serving the Mecklenburg, Cabarrus, and Rowan counties in North Carolina. Jackson says the mission of her organization is to help adults not be alone as they age. The help comes in practical ways. The hope often comes simply because we are relational. We're finding ways to be with them, she says. So many are isolated, and a simple visit brings hope and joy. EOC utilizes occupational therapists in an effort to daily connect with elder orphans, many of whom want to remain in their own home. The nonprofit partners with local churches to recruit volunteers to perform yard work and small home repairs, and has even taken over some routes from the Cabarrus County Meals on Wheels. Jackson also acknowledged that the safety nets in place for the aging in America have some holes in them, and feels that it's part of her duty to help people find a way through them. We knew we didn't want to recreate the wheel, as there are many amazing senior serving organizations in our area, but we knew we could help fill some gaps, she says. Alexander Ruffner and other advocates have stressed the importance for elder orphans to have someone they can rely on to help make medical decisions with them. Not having a built-in family member might actually be an advantage for some, Ruffner says. We do get to choose our team, she says. As we age, everybody says we want to hang on to our independence. This is how you retain your power and your control. Exercise your choices. When Alexander speaks with people facing elder orphanship, he counsels them to develop a strong, trusted friendship. He referenced the Greensboro-based Corporation for Guardianship in particular. That organization provides professional guardians who can help represent elder orphans in critical situations. Alexander says he understands the desire for many to remain independent, but a personal experience helped him learn the value of having an outside party play a role in making major decisions. His father's best friend was a man named Percy Meekins. When they were growing up, Alexander's father and Meekins pledged that when one of them died, the other would make sure the widowed spouse was taken care of. Meekins died first, and his wife Elizabeth was left alone, and the Meekins never had children. After Percy's death, Elizabeth developed severe dementia. But there was a plan in place, and Alexander's father helped manage the assets, which were eventually placed in a trust in Dare County to support arts and education. Alexander said the Meekins were fortunate to have a plan and someone to help. But often planning is not enough. The security of a guardianship is that the court looks into it every year, he says. You have to file accountings. Once you're in a guardianship, it would be pretty darn hard for someone to take financial advantage. Like Ruffner, Jackson's 61 and not married. Her family members have either died or live far away. She encourages others like her to find activities that give life purpose and meaning. In fact, she just signed up for kickboxing classes. She also says to make plans now. Everyone's growing older, and as we age, things change, Jackson says. Be creative. Don't think traditionally. We can't control a lot of what the future holds, but we can make wise choices now. Now, with this article, there's a graphic here and with additional information. And it says, Americans are becoming more likely to grow old without support systems, and here's some data to support that. Rising risk. The population at risk for becoming an elder orphan, according to a 2016 study, is 22.6%. And according to a 2010 census, 19% are women 40 to 44 years of age with no children. The number of seniors living alone in Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill is 18,616. The number of potential family caregivers for people 80 and older in 2010, according to AARP, is 7.2. Also according to AARP, the number of potential family givers for people 80 and older in 2050 is 3. Now we turn to the executive voice page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and this week's executive voice belongs to Bob Portman. What began as a summer job doing construction work in high school and college has turned into a lifelong career for Bob Portman. Now he leads one of the largest specialty subcontracting firms in the Triangle. As president and CEO of Southern Industrial Contractors, sometimes known as SIC, Portman heads the efforts of a contingency of about 1,350 people in 8 offices, 350 of whom are located in the Raleigh headquarters. The 56-year-old company has grown from a crane and rigging company to a leading provider of turnkey industrial construction and plant installation, relocation, and maintenance services in the Southeast. SIC is also now part of a larger entity called EMCOR Group. Portman says he'll be concentrating on overseeing SIC's 5-year vision and strategy plan, which focuses on what he calls the 3 pillars of the company: people, customers, and growth. So here's the Q&A. How long have you been in your current post? I've been working at SIC for more than 4 years and have held the position of president and CEO for 3 of those years. Before joining SIC, I led Southeast construction operations for a construction management firm. Prior to that, I held the position of Executive Vice President at a national mechanical contractor. So what have been some of your biggest projects recently? A $20 million telecommunications project. SIC provided electrical instrumentation, process piping, rigging, steel erection, and concrete services. A $15 million pharmaceutical project in the Triangle area. SIC provided equipment installation and steel erection services. And a $10 million combined wastewater treatment project within the power industry. SIC provided full turnkey building and systems installation. So what are your goals for the company? SIC has recently implemented a 5-year vision and strategy plan to enhance the top 3 pillars of our company, our people, our customers, and our growth. The purpose of this plan is to establish a clear vision and mission with 5-year benchmarks so that all of SIC will be focused on achieving these goals. The key to SIC's longevity in this ever-changing industry and to our success as a whole is our people. With this path forward, and knowing the talented and dedicated men and women in our SIC family will all be working together toward these common goals, I know we will be successful. So what's the biggest challenge your company currently faces? Recruiting the best candidates. What's the biggest growth driver for your business? It all comes down to hiring the best people and empowering them every day to meet the demanding needs of our customers. We have a strong family culture with managers who have an entrepreneurial spirit and who naturally stay laser-focused on customer satisfaction. So what do you think has been the biggest triumph in your leadership career? My recent SIC chili cook-off win. Ha! In all honesty, in the first year of joining SIC, we had the opportunity to congeal some concrete goals to continue to propel our growth. We developed and implemented a 3-year action plan to do so with the following objectives, all with eyes squarely focused on improving SIC's service to customers and potential customers. Grow our work in the power industry. Grow the Columbia, South Carolina office. Expand SIC's footprint in Wilmington. Expand our maintenance division. And grow our civil department. Along with these key initiatives, we set 3-year financial goals. Through SIC's hard work and execution, we hit our targets in year 2 of our 3-year plan. I laid out these lofty stretch goals, and our people made it happen. And it was a reflection of client need and responsiveness. On top of it, the SIC senior leadership team addressed any obstacles so our folks could meet their goals and do what they do best, serve client needs. Along with surpassing our goals, building an SIC senior leadership team that is passionate, talented, and does the right thing gives me a great sense of accomplishment. Finding a team of people who work well together and embody our core values, integrity, discipline, transparency, mutual respect, and trust, commitment to safety and teamwork, is not easy. It just goes to show that SIC really does have awesome, honest people. We've seen the tremendous benefits this has for our clients. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, and who gave it? Always set big, hairy, audacious goals. Bags. Before entering military service, my father told me about the bag concept, and I've adopted these as guiding principles for both my personal life and professional career. Bags is not just about checking the boxes. It's about making sure everything you do, you excel at. Don't settle for mediocrity, and good things will always happen. So what do you do to relax? Mountain bike riding, a range of outdoor sports, and basketball. I also love to take pictures of sunsets and sunrises. Finally, what books are currently on your nightstand? The Ideal Team Player by Patrick Lencioni, Alive and Well by Paul Ballmert, and Elon Musk by Ashley Vance. Now, as we end near the end of our broadcast, we turn to the Viewpoint page. And as usual, there is a guest column on the Viewpoint page, and this week's columnist is Catherine Truitt, who is Chancellor of WGU North Carolina, affiliate of the accredited nonprofit online Western Governors University. Her column is entitled Access to Higher Education for All. The Old North State has much to be proud of when it comes to the affordability of our higher education institutions. Even though average tuition and fees at 4-year colleges and universities in the U.S. have risen nearly 4 times faster than the inflation rate over the past decade, Our state's leaders have continued their commitment to maintain a world-class university system that North Carolina families can afford. State funding for the system ranks 9th in the country, and although tuition has increased 44.5% since 2008, the average tuition at our public universities is the 8th lowest in the U.S. And best of all, average student debt for North Carolina's graduates in 2016 was the 8th lowest in the country. It sounds like an all-out win for a state whose economic health and job growth continue to be the envy of nearly every other state in the country. However, a new study conducted by Rebecca Tippett of Carolina Demography has cast a shadow on the situation. Tippett found that only about 1 of every 5 high school seniors in North Carolina will complete a 4-year degree within 6 years after graduation, and only 15% will do so at a UNC system school. This means that nearly 80% of graduates will not be able to reap the benefits of a university degree before age 25. In addition, there already are 645,000 early and mid-career adults aged 25 to 54 with only some college and no degree. This is problematic because North Carolina's job growth is on track to outstrip its population growth by 2024, and if businesses can't find the qualified employees they need, they will take those jobs elsewhere. If we are to leverage the talent we have here in North Carolina, we must provide additional pathways to higher education for our citizens. According to NC State University economist Michael Walden, colleges and universities need to be agile if they are to continue helping ensure workforce preparedness in the future. Walden argues that higher education institutions must be able to keep track of occupational shifts, reallocate resources as these changes occur, and accommodate more adult students who are changing careers. Many North Carolinians face various obstacles in their pursuit of higher education, including cost. The federal government currently holds $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loans, and the Department of Education claims federal student aid's loan portfolio now accounts for nearly 10% of America's national debt. Forbes magazine reports that student loan debt is now the second highest consumer debt category, behind only mortgages. Other obstacles, including time, particularly for working adults, and distance to traditional brick-and-mortar institutions of higher learning. In rural areas, a drive to the nearest college campus can take an hour or more for some. One potential solution is nonprofit accredited online universities that offer curriculums for in-demand jobs like IT, healthcare, education, and business. Online universities without campuses or athletic departments can offer lower tuition. Freed from centuries-old educational approaches, online universities can deliver disruptive models like competency-based education that reward students for mastering knowledge and skills at their own pace, rather than for time spent in the classroom. This is a viable option for many working adults juggling jobs, families, and studies. The hard truth is that jobs today, and especially tomorrow, require more education, skills, and knowledge than ever before. In a global economy increasingly dominated by machine learning, AI, nanotechnology, and a host of other technical advancements, employees without advanced degrees will be left behind. States that choose not to ensure all of their citizens have easy access to affordable quality higher education opportunities will be as well. The time is now for North Carolina to embrace innovation in higher education. And also on the Viewpoint page of this week's TBJ is the editor's notebook. That's entitled, With New Jobs for Raleigh Comes New Responsibility. I don't recall a time in recent memory when so many economic development announcements were made within such a short time frame. First came the news that Fortune 500 company Advance Auto Parts is moving its corporate headquarters from Virginia to Raleigh and will pump some 435 new jobs into the market with an average salary of $107,000. A day later, we heard New Jersey-based Fortune 100 entity Honeywell would be moving its corporate headquarters to Charlotte, adding 750 new jobs that could pay an average salary of $85,000. And on December 3rd, Raleigh's Pendo, a tech concern, pledged that it will add another 590 jobs in the Triangle. CEO Todd Olson added that the average salary of these jobs will top $86,824. That's a lot of action in just a few days. Let's analyze what we're seeing. North Carolina's median household income is $50,584, according to the U.S. Census ACS one-year survey. In Raleigh, however, the average salary is $56,126. In Wake, the median household income is $63,770. These announced jobs in the past few days carry salaries that are way more than our median and average numbers. That also means the area must now meet the demands of having a skilled, available workforce. Advance Auto, Pendo, Honeywell, and others are not looking for paper pushers and time card punchers. They're looking for workers who can challenge the current processes with critical thinking and innovative solutions. Again, we must rely on our high schools and colleges to keep our workforce pipeline full. I talked to a few executives this week about these jobs-heavy announcements, and they unanimously agreed that these relocations and expansions that come with hundreds of jobs would be easier to absorb for our communities than perhaps if had Amazon given Raleigh the green light and started with 5,000 jobs with a potential of 25,000 down the road. It's not that Amazon would not have been a great win. It has to do more with the diversity of jobs that, in turn, makes it sustainable long-term. If Amazon's business model fails to deliver the goods at some point, the company would be exposed to workforce reduction. What are the chances that AAP, Honeywell, and Pendo, which all operate in different industries, would sustain devastating slowdowns at the same time? Chances are slim, of course, unless we're staring at another great recession. Despite the potential of economic headwinds, nothing suggests we're going back to the days of 2009. Finally, our lawmakers, both at the state and local level, need to be aware of the needs of these businesses ready to spend millions of dollars in capital projects and, of course, payroll. Constant opposition to any form of growth by forwarding superficial outrage about social issues is often transparent to the job creators. Trust me, they will take their relocation and expansions elsewhere. Perhaps it's even more important right now for government and business to work together for a greater good, because in recent days, at least three companies have put their trust in North Carolina to do the right thing. Well, that music means we've run out of time for this week's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.